Prince Oberon and his lords, in a corner fort facing the city, as far from the Tyrells as he could put them, without evicting them from the Red Keep entirely. It was not nearly far enough. Already there had been a brawl in a flea-bottomed potshop that left one Tyrell man-at-arms dead, and two of Lord Gargalen scalded, and an uglier confrontation in the yard, when Mace Tyrell's wizened little mother called Ilaria Sand the Serpent's Whore. Every time he chanced to see Oberon Martell, the prince asked when the justice would be served. Overcooked peas were the least of Tyrion's troubles, but he saw no point in burdening his young wife with any of that. Sansa had enough griefs of her own.
"The peas suffice," he told her curtly. "They are green and round. What more can one expect of peas? Here, I'll have another serving, if it please my lady."
He beckoned, and Podrick Payne spooned so many peas onto his plate that Tyrion lost sight of his mutton.
"That was stupid," he told himself. "Now I have to eat them all, or she'll be sorry all over again."
The supper ended in a strained silence, as so many of their suppers did. Afterward, as Pod was removing the cups and platters, Sansa asked Tyrion for leave to visit the Godswood.
"As you wish."
He had become accustomed to his wife's nightly devotions. She prayed at the royal sept as well, and often lit candles to mother, maid, and crone. Tyrion found all this piety excessive, if truth be told, but in her place he might want the help of the gods as well.
"I confess I know little of the old gods," he said, trying to be pleasant. "Perhaps some day you might enlighten me. I could even accompany you."
"No," Sansa said at once. You are kind to offer, but there are no devotions, my lord. No priests or songs or candles, only trees and silent prayer. You would be bored."
"No doubt you're right. She knows me better than I thought. Though the sound of rustling leaves might be a pleasant change from some septon droning on about the seven aspects of grace."
Tyrion waved her off.
I won't intrude. Dress warmly, my lady. The wind is brisk out there."
He was tempted to ask what she prayed for, but Sansa was so dutiful she might actually tell him, and he didn't think he wanted to know. He went back to work after she'd left, trying to track some golden dragons through the labyrinth of Littlefinger's ledgers. Petyr Baelish had not believed in letting gold sit about and grow dusty, that was for certain, but the more Tyrion tried to make sense of his accounts, the more his head hurt. It was all very well to talk of breeding dragons instead of locking them up in the treasury, but some of these ventures smell worse than weak old fish.
"I wouldn't have been so quick to let Joffrey fling the antler men over the walls, if I'd known how many of the bloody bastards had taken loans from the crown.
He would have to send Bronn to find their heirs, but he feared that would prove as fruitful as trying to squeeze silver from a silverfish." When the summons from his lord father arrived, it was the first time Tyrion could ever recall being pleased to see Sir Boris Blunt. He closed the ledgers gratefully, blew out the oil lamp, tied a cloak around his shoulders, and waddled across the castle to the Tower of the Hand. The wind was brisk, just as he'd warned Sansa, and there was a smell of rain in the air. Perhaps when Lord Tywin was done with him, he should go to the Guard's Wood and fetch her home before she got soaked. But all that went straight out of his head when he entered the Hand Solar to find Cersei, Sir Kevin, and Grand Maester Pycelle gathered about Lord Tywin and the king. Joffrey was almost bouncing, and Cersei was savouring a smug little smile, though Lord Tywin looked as grim as ever.
"I wonder if he could smile, even if he wanted to."
"What's happened?" Tyrion asked. His father offered him a roll of parchment. Someone had flattened it, but it still wanted to curl.
"Rosalind caught a fine fat trout," the message read.
"Her brothers gave her a pair of wolf pelts for her wedding." Tyrion turned it over to inspect the broken seal. The wax was silvery grey, and pressed into it were the twin towers of House Frey.
"Does the Lord of the Crossing imagine he's being poetic, or is this meant to confound us?"
Tyrion snorted.
"The trout would be Edmure Tully. The pelts. He's dead.
Joffrey sounded so proud and happy, you might have thought he'd skinned Robb Stark himself.
First Greyjoy, and now Stark.
Tyrion thought of his child wife praying in the God's Wood even now,
praying to her father's gods to bring her brother victory and keep her mother safe, no doubt.
The old guards paid no more heed to prayer than the new ones, it would seem.
Perhaps he should take comfort in that. "Kings are falling like leaves this autumn," he said. "It will seem our little war is winning itself."
"Wars do not win themselves, Tyrion," Cersei said with poisonous sweetness. "Our Lord Father won this war."
"Nothing is won so long as we have enemies in the field," Lord Tywin warned them.
"The River Lords are no fools," the Queen argued. "Without the Northmen, they cannot hope to stand against the combined power of Highgarden, Castle Rock, and Dorne. Surely they will choose submission rather than destruction."
"Most," agreed Lord Tywin. "River Run remains, but so long as Walder Frey holds Edmure Tully hostage, the Blackfish dare not mount a threat. Jason Mallister and Tyrus Blackwood will fight on for honour's sake, but the Freys can keep the Mallisters penned up at Seaguard, and with the right inducement, Jonas Bracken can be persuaded to change his allegiance and attack the Blackwoods. In the end, they will bend the knee, yes. I mean to offer generous terms. Any castle that yields to us will be spared, save one."
"Harrenhal," said Tyrion, who knew his sire.
"The realm is best rid of these brave companions. I have commanded Sir Gregor to put the castle to the sword."
Gregor Clegane.
It appeared as if his lord father meant to mine the mountain for every last nugget of ore before turning him over to Dornish justice. The brave companions would end as heads on spikes, and Littlefinger would stroll into Harrenhal without so much as a spot of blood on those fine clothes of his. He wondered if Pataia Baelish had reached the Vale yet.
If the guards are good, he ran into a storm at sea and sank. But when had the guards ever been especially good?
"They should all be put to the sword," Joffrey declared suddenly. "The Mallisters and Blackwoods and Brackens, all of them. They're traitors. I want them killed, Grandfather. I won't have any generous terms."
The king turned to Grand Maester Pycelle.
"And I want Robb Stark's head, too. Write to Lord Frey and tell him. The king commands. I'm going to have it served to Sansa at my wedding feast."
"Sire," Sir Kevin said in a shocked voice, "the lady is now your aunt by marriage."
"A jest," Cersei smiled. "Joff did not mean it." "Yes, I did," Joffrey insisted. "He was a traitor, and I want his stupid head. I'm going to make Sansa kiss it."
"No."
Tyrion's voice was hoarse. "Sansa is no longer yours to torment. Understand that, Munster?" Joffrey sneered.
"You're the Munster, uncle."
"Am I?" Tyrion cocked his head. "Perhaps you should speak more softly to me, then. Munsters are dangerous beasts, and just now kings seem to be dying like flies."
"I can have your tongue out for saying that," the boy king said, reddening. "I'm the king."
Cersei put a protective hand on her son's shoulder. "Let the dwarf make all the threats she likes, Joff. I want my lord father and my uncle to see what he is." Lord Tywin ignored that. It was Joff he addressed.
"Aerys also felt the need to remind men that he was king, and he was passing fond of ripping tongues out as well. You could ask Sir Ilyan Payne about that, though you'll get no reply."
"Sir Ilyan never dared provoke Aerys the way your imp provokes Joff," said Cersei. "You heard him. Munster, he said, to the king's grace, and he threatened him."
"Be quiet, Cersei. Joffrey, when your enemies defy you, you must serve them steel and fire. When they go to their knees, however, you must help them back to their feet. Elsewise, no man will ever bend the knee to you. And any man who must say, I am the king, is no true king at all. Ares never understood that, but you will. When I've won your war for you, we will restore the king's peace and the king's justice. The only head that need concern you is Margaery Tyrell's maiden head.
Joffrey had that sullen, sulky look he got. Cersei had him firmly by the shoulder, but perhaps she should have had him by the throat. The boy surprised them all. Instead of scuttling safely back under his rock, Joffrey drew himself up defiantly and said,
You talk about Ares, Grandfather, but you were scared of him.
Oh, my, hasn't this gotten interesting?
Tyrion thought. Lord Tywin studied his grandchild in silence, gold flecks shining in his pale green eyes. Joffrey, apologize to your grandfather, said Cersei. He wrenched free of her.
Why should I? Everyone knows it's true. My father won all the battles. He killed Prince Rhaegar and took the crown, while your father was hiding under Castle Rock.
The boy gave his grandfather a defiant look.
A strong king acts boldly. He doesn't just talk.
Thank you for that wisdom, Your Grace, Lord Tywin said, with a courtesy so cold it was like to freeze their ears off. Thank heaven. I can see the king is tired. Please see him safely back to his bedchamber. Pycelle, perhaps some gentle potion to help his grace sleep restfully.
Dream wine, my lord?
I don't want any dream wine, Joffrey insisted.
Lord Tywin would have paid more heed to a mouse squeaking in the corner.
A dream wine will serve. Cersei, Tyrion, remain.
Sir Kevin took Joffrey firmly by the arm and marched him out of the door, where two of the king's guard were waiting. Grand Maester Pycelle scurried after them as fast as his shaky old legs could take him. Tyrion remained where he was. "Father, I'm sorry," Cersei said when the door was shut. "Joff has always been willful. I did warn you."
"There is a long league's worth of difference between willful and stupid. A strong king acts boldly. Who told him that?"
"Not me, I promise you," said Cersei. "Most like it was something he heard Robert say."
"The part about you hiding under Castle Rock does sound like Robert."
Tyrion didn't want Lord Tywin forgetting that bit.
"Yes, I recall now," Cersei said. "Robert often told Joff that a king must be bold."
"And what were you telling him, pray?" "I did not fight a war to seat Robert the Second on the Iron Throne. You gave me to understand the boy cared nothing for his father."
"Why would he? Robert ignored him. He would have beat him if I'd allowed it. That brute you made me marry once hit the boy so hard he knocked out two of his baby teeth over some mischief with a cat. I told him I'd kill him in his sleep if he ever did it again. And he never did. But sometimes he would say things.
It appears things needed to be said."
Lord Tywin waved two fingers at her, a brusque dismissal.
"Go!"
She went, seething.
"Not Robert the Second," Tyrion said. "Ares the Third."
"The boy is 13. There is time yet."
Lord Tywin paced to the window. That was unlike him. He was more upset than he wished to show.
"He requires a sharp lesson."
Tyrion had gotten his own sharp lesson at 13. He felt almost sorry for his nephew. On the other hand, no one deserved it more.
"Enough of Joffrey," he said. "Wars are worn with quills and ravens. Wasn't that what you said? I must congratulate you. How long have you and Waldo Frey been plotting this?"
"I mislike that word," Lord Tywin said stiffly.
"And I mislike being left in the dark."
"There was no reason to tell you. You had no part in this."
"Was Cersei told?" Tyrion demanded to know.
"No one was told, save those who had a part to play, and they were only told as much as they needed to know. You ought to know that there is no other way to keep a secret, here especially. My object was to rid us of a dangerous enemy as cheaply as I could, not to indulge your curiosity or make your sister feel important.
He closed the shutters, frowning.
"You have a certain cunning, Tyrion, but the plain truth is, you talk too much. That loose tongue of yours will be your undoing."
"You should have let Joff tear it out," suggested Tyrion.
"You would do well not to tempt me," Lord Tywin said. "I'll hear no more of it. I have been considering how best to appease Oberyn Martell and his entourage."
"Oh, is this something I'm allowed to know, or should I leave so you can discuss it with yourself?" His father ignored the sally.
"Prince Oberon's presence here is unfortunate. His brother is a cautious man, a reasoned man, subtle, deliberate, even indolent to a degree. He is a man who weighs the consequences of every word and every action. But Oberon has always been half mad."
"Is it true he tried to raise Dorne for Viserys?"
"No one speaks of it, but yes. Ravens flew, and riders rode. With what secret messages I never knew. John Arryn sailed to Sonspear to return Prince Lewin's bones, sat down with Prince Doran, and ended all the talk of war. But Robert never went to Dorne thereafter, and Prince Oberyn seldom left it."
"Well, he's here now, with half the nobility of Dorne in his tail, and he grows more impatient every day," said Tyrion. "Perhaps I should show him the brothels of King's Landing. That might distract him. A tool for every task. Isn't that how it works? My tool is yours, father. Never let it be said that House Lannister blew its trumpets and I did not respond."
Lord Tywin's mouth tightened. "Very droll. Shall I have them sew you a suit of motley and a little hat with bells on it?"
"If I wear it, do I have leave to say anything I want about His Grace King Joffrey?"
Lord Tywin seated himself again and said, "I was made to suffer my father's follies. I will not suffer yours. Enough."
"Very well, as you ask so pleasantly. The Red Viper is not going to be pleasant, I fear. Nor will he content himself with Sir Gregor's head alone."
"All the more reason not to give it to him."
"Not to—" Tyrion was shocked. "I thought we were agreed that the woods were full of beasts."
"Lesser beasts."
Lord Tywin's fingers laced together under his chin.
"Sir Gregor has served us well. No other knight in the realm inspires such terror in our enemies."
"Oberyn knows that Gregor was the one who—"
"He knows nothing. He has heard tales, stable gossip, and kitchen calumnies. He has no crumb of proof. Sir Gregor is certainly not about to confess to him. I mean to keep him well away for so long as the Dornishmen are in King's Landing."
"And when Oberyn demands the justice he's come for?"
"I will tell him that Sir Aemry Lorch killed Elia and her children," Lord Tywin said calmly. "So will you, if he asks."
"Sir Aemry Lorch is dead," Tyrion said flatly.
"Precisely. Vargo Hoat had Sir Aemry torn apart by a bear after the fall of Harrenhal. That ought to be sufficiently grisly to appease even Oberyn Martell."
"You may call that justice."
"It is justice. It was Sir Aemry who brought me the girl's body, if you must know. He found her hiding under her father's bed, as if she believed Rhaegar could still protect her. Princess Elia and the babe were in the nursery a floor below."
"Well, it's a tale, and Sir Aemry is not like to deny it. What will you tell Oberyn when he asks who gave Lorch his orders?"
"Sir Aemry acted on his own in the hope of winning favour from the new king. Robert's hatred for Rhaegar was scarcely a secret."
"It might serve," Tyrion had to concede. "But the snake will not be happy. Far be it from me to question your cunning, father, but in your place I do believe I'd have let Robert Baratheon bloody his own hands." Lord Tywin stared at him as if he'd lost his wits.
"You deserve that motley, then. We had come late to Robert's cause. It was necessary to demonstrate our loyalty. When I laid those bodies before the throne, no man could doubt that we had forsaken House Targaryen forever. And Robert's relief was palpable. As stupid as he was, even he knew that Rhaegar's children had to die if his throne was ever to be secure. Yet he saw himself as a hero. And heroes do not kill children. His father shrugged. I grant you, it was done too brutally. Ilya need not have been harmed at all. That was sheer folly. By herself, she was nothing.
Then why did the mountain kill her?
Because I did not tell him to spare her. I doubt I mentioned her at all. I had more pressing concerns. Ned Stark's van was rushing south from the Trident, and I feared it might come to swords between us. And it was in Aerys to murder Jaime, with no more cause than spite. That was the thing I feared most, that, and what Jaime himself might do.
He closed a fist.
Nor did I yet grasp what I had in Gregor Clegane, only that he was huge and terrible in battle. The rape! Even you will not accuse me of giving that command, I would hope. Sir Aemry was almost as bestial with Rhaenys. I asked him afterwards why it had required 50 thrusts to kill a girl of 2, 3. He said she'd kicked him and would not stop screaming. If Lorch had half the wits the guards gave a turnip, he would have calmed her with a few sweet words and used a soft silk pillow. His mouth twisted in distaste. The blood was in him.
But not in you, father. There's no blood in Tywin Lannister. Was it a soft silk pillow that slew Robb Stark?
It was to be an arrow at Edmure Tully's wedding feast. The boy was too wary in the field. He kept his men in good order and surrounded himself with outriders and bodyguards.
So Lord Walder slew him under his own roof, at his own table. Tyrion made a fist. What of Lady Catelyn?
Slain as well, I'd say. A pair of wolfskins. Frey had intended to keep her captive, but perhaps something went awry.
So much for guest right.
The blood is on Walder Frey's hands, and not mine.
Walder Frey is a peevish old man who lives to fondle his young wife and brood over all the slights he suffered. I have no doubt he hatched this ugly chicken, but he would never have dared such a thing without a promise of protection.
I suppose you would have spared the boy, and told Lord Frey you had no need of his allegiance. That would have driven the old fool right back into Stark's arms, and won you another year of war. Explain to me why it is more noble to kill 10,000 men in battle than a dozen at dinner.
When Tyrion had no reply to that, his father continued.
The price was cheap by any measure. The crown shall grant River Run to Sir Eamon Frey once the Blackfish yields. Lancel and Devon must marry Frey girls. Joy is to wed one of Lord Walder's natural sons when she's old enough, and Roose Bolton becomes Warden of the North and takes home Arya Stark.
Arya Stark? Tyrion cocked his head. And Bolton? I might have known Frey would not have the stomach to act alone, but Arya? Varys and Sir Jaslyn search for her for more than 50 years. Arya Stark is surely dead.
So was Renly, until the Blackwater.
What does that mean?
Perhaps Littlefinger succeeded where you and Varys failed. Lord Bolton will wed the girl to his bastard son. We shall allow the Dreadfort to fight the Ironborn for a few years, and see if he can bring Stark's other bannermen to heel. Come spring, all of them should be at the end of their strength, and ready to bend the knee. The North will go to your son by Sansa Stark, if you ever find enough manhood in you to breed one. lest you forget, it is not only Joffrey who must needs take a Maidenhead.
I had not forgotten, though I'd hoped you had. And when do you imagine Sansa will be at her most fertile? Tyrion asked his father in tones that dripped acid. Before or after I tell her how we murdered her mother and her brother? Davos. For a moment it seemed as though the king had not heard. Stannis showed no pleasure at the news, no anger, no disbelief, not even relief. He stared at his painted table with teeth clenched hard. "You are certain?" he asked.
"I am not seeing the body now, your kingliness," said Salador San. "Yet in the city the lions prance and dance. The Red Wedding, the small folk are calling it. They swear Lord Frey had the boy's head hacked off, sewed the head of his direwolf in its place, and nailed a crown about his ears. His lady mother was slain as well, and thrown naked in a river."
"At a wedding," thought Davos, "as he sat at his slayer's board, a guest beneath his roof. These Freys are cursed."
He could smell the burning blood again, and hear the leech hissing and spitting on the brazier's hot coals.
"It was the Lord's wrath that slew him," Sir Axel Florent declared. "It was the hand of Rhaenyra." "Praise the Lord of Light," sang out Queen Selyse, a pinched, thin, hard woman with large ears and a hairy upper lip.
"Is the hand of Rhaenyra spotted and palsied?" asked Stannis. "This sounds more Waldo Frey's handiwork than any god's."
"Rhaenyra chooses such instruments as he requires." The ruby at Melisandre's throat shone redly. "His ways are mysterious, yet no man may withstand his fiery will."
"No man can withstand him," the queen cried.
"Be quiet, woman. You're not at a night fire now." Stannis considered the painted table. "The wolf leaves no heirs. The kraken too many. The lions will devour them unless... Son, I will require your fastest ships to carry envoys to the Iron Islands and White Harbour. I shall offer... pardons." The way he snapped his teeth showed how little he liked that word. "Full pardons for all those who repent of treason and swear fealty to their rightful king. They must see..."
"They will not." Melisandre's voice was soft. "I am sorry, Your Grace. This is not an end. More false kings will soon rise to take up the crowns of those who've died."
"More?" Stannis looked as though he would gladly have throttled her. "More usurpers? More traitors?"
"I have seen it in the flames."
Queen Selyse went to the king's side.
"The Lord of Light sent Melisandre to guide you to your glory. Heed her, I beg you. Rhaenyra's holy flames do not lie."
"There are lies and lies, woman. Even when the flames speak truly, they are full of tricks, it seems to me."
"An ant who hears the words of a king may not comprehend what he is saying," Melisandre said, "and all men are ants before the fiery face of God. If sometimes I have mistaken a warning for a prophecy, or a prophecy for a warning, the fault lies in the reader, not the book. But this I know for a certainty. Envoys and pardons will not serve you now, no more than leeches. You must show the realm a sign that proves your power."
"Power?" The king snorted. "I have 1,300 men on Dragonstone, another 300 at Storm's End." His hand swept over the painted table. "The rest of Westeros is in the hands of my foes. I have no fleet but Salador Sands, no coin to hire or sell swords, no prospect of plunder or glory to lure free riders to my cause."
"Lord Husband," said Queen Selyse, "you have more men than Aegon did 300 years ago. All you lack are dragons."
The look Stannis gave her was dark. 9 mages crossed the sea to hatch Aegon the Third's cache of eggs. Baelor the Blessed prayed over his for half a year. Aegon the Fourth built dragons of wood and iron. Arian Brightflame drank wildfire to transform himself. The mages failed. King Balor's prayers went unanswered. The wooden dragons burned, and Prince Arian died screaming. Queen Selyse was adamant. None of these was the chosen of R'hllor. No red comet blazed across the heavens to herald their coming. None wielded Lightbringer, the red sword of heroes, and none of them paid the price. Lady Melisandre will tell you, my lord, only death can pay for life. The boy! The king almost spat the words. The boy, agreed the queen. The boy, Sir Axel echoed. I was sick unto death of this wretched boy before he was even born, the king complained. His very name is a roaring in my ears and a dark cloud upon my soul. Give the boy to me, and you need never hear his name spoken again, Melisandre promised. No, but you'll hear him screaming when she burns him. Davos held his tongue. It was wiser not to speak until the king commanded it. Give me the boy for R'hllor, the red woman said, and the ancient prophecy shall be fulfilled. Your dragon shall awaken and spread his stony wings. The kingdom shall be yours. Sir Axel went to one knee.
On bended knee, I beg you, sire, wake the stone dragon and let the traitors tremble. Like Aegon, ye begin as Lord of Dragonstone. Like Aegon, ye shall conquer. Let the false and the fickle feel your flames.
Your own wife begs as well, Lord Husband. Queen Selyse went down on both knees before the king, hands clasped as if in prayer. Robert Andelina defiled our bed and laid a curse upon our union. This boy is the foul fruit of their fornications. Lift his shadow from my womb, and I will bear you many true-born sons, I know it. She threw her arms around his legs. He is only one boy born of your brother's lust and my cousin's shame. He is mine own blood. Stop clutching me, woman. King Stannis put a hand on her shoulder, awkwardly untangling himself from her grasp. Perhaps Robert did curse our marriage bed. He swore to me that he never meant to shame me, that he was drunk, and never knew which bedchamber he entered that night. But does it matter? The boy was not at fault, whatever the truth. Melisandre put a hand on the king's arm. The Lord of Light cherishes the innocent. There's no sacrifice more precious. From his king's blood and his untainted fire, a dragon shall be born. Stannis did not pull away from Melisandre's touch, as he had from his queen's. The red woman was all Selyse was not, young, full-bodied, and strangely beautiful, with her heart-shaped face, coppery hair, and unearthly red eyes. It would be a wondrous thing to see stone come to life, he admitted grudgingly, and to mount a dragon. I remember the first time my father took me to court. Robert had to hold my hand. I could not have been older than 4, which would have made him 5 or 6. We agreed afterward that the king had been as noble as the dragons were fearsome. Stannis snorted. Years later, our father told us that Ares had cut himself on the throne that morning, so his hand had taken his place. It was Tywin Lannister who'd so impressed us. His fingers touched the surface of the table, tracing a path lightly across the varnished hills. Robert took the skulls down when he'd done the crown, but he could not bear to have them destroyed. Dragon wings over Westeros. There would be such a... Your Grace, Davos edged forward. Might I speak? Stannis closed his mouth so hard his teeth snapped. My Lord of the Rainwood, why do you think I made your hand, if not to speak? The king waved a hand. Say what you will.
Warrior, make me brave. I know little of dragons and less of gods, but the queen spoke of curses. No man is as cursed as a kinslayer in the eyes of gods and men.
There are no gods save R'hllor, and the other whose name must not be spoken.
Melisandre's mouth made a hard red line. And small men curse what they cannot understand.
I am a small man, Davos admitted,
So tell me why you need this boy, Edric Storm, to wait your great stone dragon, my lady.
He was determined to say the boy's name as often as he could.
Only death can pay for life, my lord. A great gift requires a great sacrifice.
Where is the greatness in a base-born child?
He has king's blood in his veins. You have seen what even a little of that blood could do.
I saw you burn some leeches.
And two false kings are dead.
Robb Stark was murdered by Lord Walder of the Crossing, and we have heard that Balon Greyjoy fell from a bridge. Who did your leeches kill?
Do you doubt the power of R'hllor? No.
Davos remembered too well the living shadow that had squirmed from out of her womb, that night beneath Storm's End, its black hands pressing at her thighs.
I must go carefully here, or some shadow may come seeking me as well.
Even an onion smuggler knows two onions from three. You are short a king, my lady.
Stannis gave a snort of laughter.
He has you there, my lady. Two is not three.
To be sure, your grace, one king might die by chance, even two. But three? If Joffrey should die in the midst of all his power, surrounded by his armies and King's Guard, would not that show the power of the Lord at work?
It might. The king spoke as if he grudged every word.
Or not.
Davos did his best to hide his fear.
Joffrey shall die,
Queen Selyse declared, serene in her confidence.
It may be that he's dead already,
Sir Axel added. Stannis looked at them with annoyance. Are you trained crows to croak at me in turns? Enough!
Husband, hear me,
the queen entreated.
Why?
Two is not three. Kings can count as well as smugglers. You may go. Stannis turned his back on them. Melisandre helped the queen to her feet. Selyse swept stiffly from the chamber, the red woman trailing behind. Sir Axel lingered long enough to give Davos one last look.
An ugly look on an ugly face,
he thought as he met the stare. After the others had gone, Davos cleared his throat. The king looked up.
Why are you still here?
Sire, about Edric Storm.
Stannis made a sharp gesture.
Spare me.
Davos persisted.
Your daughter takes her lessons with him, and plays with him every day in Aegon's garden.
I know that. Her heart would break if anything ill should.
I know that as well.
If you would only see him.
I have seen him.
He looks like Robert.
Aye, and worships him.
Shall I tell him how often his beloved father ever gave him a thought? My brother liked the making of children well enough, but after birth they were a bother.
He asks after you every day. He...
You're making me angry, Davos. I will hear no more of this bastard boy.
His name is Edric Storm, sire.
I know his name. Was there ever a name so apt? It proclaims his bastardy, his high birth, and the turmoil he brings with him. Edric Storm. There, I've said it.
Are you satisfied, my lord Hand?
Edric,
he started.
Is one boy. He may be the best boy who ever drew breath, and it would not matter. My duty is to the realm. His hand swept across the painted table. How many boys dwell in Westeros? How many girls? How many men? How many women? The darkness will devour them all, she says. The night that never ends. She talks of prophecies. A hero reborn in the sea, living dragons hatched from dead stone. She speaks of signs, and swears they point at me.
I never asked for this, no more than I asked to be king.
Yet dare I disregard her?
He ground his teeth.
We do not choose our destinies, yet we must do our duty. No? Great or small, we must do our duty. Medicine swears that she has seen me in her flames, facing the dark, with Lightbringer raised on high. Lightbringer!
Stannis gave a derisive snort.
Cheh!
It glimmers prettily, I'll grant you, but on the Blackwater this magic sword served me no better than any common steel. A dragon would have turned that battle. Aegon once stood here, as I do, looking down on this table. Do you think we would name him Aegon the Conqueror today, if he had not had dragons?
Your Grace, said Davos, the cost.
I know the cost. Last night, gazing into that hearth, I saw things in the flames as well. I saw a king, a crown of fire on his brows, burning. Burning, Davos. His own crown consumed his flesh and turned him into ash. Do you think I need Melisande to tell me what that means? Or you? The king moved so his shadow fell upon King's Landing. If Joffrey should die, what is the life of one bastard boy against a kingdom?
Everything, said Davos softly.
Stannis looked at him, jaw clenched.
Go,
the king said at last, before you talk yourself back into the dungeon. Sometimes the storm winds blow so strong, a man has no choice but to furl his sails.
Aye, your grace.
Davos bowed, but Stannis had seemingly forgotten him already. It was chilly in the yard when he left the stone drum. A wind blew briskly from the east, making the banner snap and flap noisily along the walls. Davos could smell salt in the air.
The sea.
He loved that smell. It made him want to walk a deck again, to raise his canvas and sail off south, to Maria and his two small ones. He thought of them most every day now, and even more at night. Part of him wanted nothing so much as to take Devon and go home.
I cannot. Not yet. I am a lord now, and the king's hand. I must not fail him.
He raised his eyes to gaze up at the walls. In place of Merlin's, a thousand grotesques and gargoyles looked down on him, each different from all the others. Wyverns, griffins, demons, manticores, minotaurs, basilisks, hellhounds, cockatrices, and a thousand queerer creatures sprouted from the castle's battlements as if they'd grown there. And the dragons were everywhere. The great hall was a dragon lying on its belly. Men entered through its open mouth. The kitchens were a dragon curled up in a ball, with the smoke and steam of the ovens vented through its nostrils. The towers were dragons hunched above the walls or poised for flight. The windworm seemed to scream defiance, while Sea Dragon Tower gazed serenely out across the waves. Smaller dragons framed the gates. Dragon claws emerged from walls to grasp at torches. Great stone wings enfolded the smith and armory, and tails formed arches, bridges, and exterior stairs. Davos had often heard it said that the wizards of Valyria did not cut and chisel, as common masons did, but work stone with fire and magic, as a potter might work clay. But now he wondered,
what if they were real dragons, somehow turned to stone?
If the Red Woman brings them to life, the castle will come crashing down, I'm thinking. What kind of dragons are full of rooms and stairs and furniture, and windows, and chimneys, and privy shafts?
Davos turned to find Salador Saan beside him.
Does this mean you have forgiven my treachery, Salar?
The old pirate wagged a finger at him.
Forgiving, yes. Forgetting, no. All that good gold on Claw Isle, that might have been mine. It makes me tired and old to think of it. When I die impoverished, my wives and my concubines will curse you, Onion Lord. Lord Celtigar had many fine wines that now I am not tasting. A sea eagle he had trying to fly from the wrist, and a magic horn to summon krakens from the deep. Very useful such a horn would be to pull down Tairashi and other vexing creatures. But do I have this horn to blow? No, because the king made my old friend, his hand.
He slipped his arm through Davos's and said,
the queen's men love you not, old friend. I am hearing that a certain hand has been making friends of his own. This is true, yes. You err too much, you old pirate.
A smuggler had best know men as well as tides, or he would not live to smuggle long. The Queen's men might remain fervent followers of the Lord of Light, but the lesser folk of Dragonstone were drifting back to the guards they'd known all their lives. They said Stannis was ensorcelled, that Melisandre had turned him away from the Seven to bow before some demon out of shadow and, worst sin of all, that she and her god had failed him. And there were knights and lordlings who felt the same. Davos had sought them out, choosing them with the same care with which he had once picked his crews. Sir Gerald Gower had fought stoutly on the Blackwater, but afterward had been heard to say that R'hllor must be a feeble god to let his followers be chased off by a dwarf and a dead man. Sir Andrew Estamont was the king's cousin, and had served as his squire years ago. The bastard of Nightsong had commanded the rearguard that allowed Stannis to reach the safety of Salador San's galleys, but he worshipped the warrior with a faith as fierce as he was. King's men, not queen's men. But it would not do to boast of them. A certain Lycene pirate once told me that a good smuggler stays out of sight, Davos replied carefully. Black sails, muffled oars, and a crew that knows how to hold their tongues. The Lycene laughed. A crew with no tongues is even better, eh? Big, stronger mutes who cannot read or write. But then he grew more somber. But I am glad to know that someone watches your back, old friend. Will the king give the boy to the Red Priestess, do you think? One little dragon could end this great big war. Old habit made him reach for his luck, but his finger bones no longer hung about his neck, and he found nothing. He will not do it, said Davos. He could not harm his own blood. Lord Renly would be glad to hear this. Renly was a traitor in arms. Edric Storm is innocent of any crime. His grace is a just man. Sala shrugged. Well, we shall be seeing. Or you shall. For myself, I am returning to sea. Even now, rascally smugglers may be sailing across the Blackwater Bay, hoping to avoid paying their lord's lawful duties. He slapped Davos on the back. Take care. You, with your mute friends. You are grown so very great now. Yet the higher a man climbs, the farther he has to fall. Davos reflected on those words as he climbed the steps of Sea Dragon Tower to the maester's chambers below the rookery. He did not need Sala to tell him he had risen too high. I cannot read. I cannot write. The lords despise me. I know nothing of ruling. How can I be the king's hand? I belong on the deck of a ship, not in a castle tower.
He had said as much to Maester Pylos. You are a notable captain, the maester replied. A captain rules his ship, does he not? He must navigate treacherous waters, set his sails to catch the rising wind, know when a storm is coming, and how best to weather it. This is much the same. Pylos meant it kindly, but his assurances rang hollow.
It's not at all the same, Davos had protested. A kingdom's not a ship, and a good thing, or this kingdom would be sinking. I know wood and rope and water, yes, but how will that serve me now? Where do I find the wind to blow King Stannis to his throne?
The maester laughed at that. And there you have it, my lord. Words are wind, you know, and you've blown mine away with your good sense. His grace knows what he has in you, I think.
Onions, said Davos glumly. That is what he has in me. The king's hand should be a high-born lord, someone wise and learned, a battle commander or a great knight.
Sir Ryan Redwine was the greatest knight of his day, and one of the worst hands ever to serve a king. Septon Murmison's prayers worked miracles, but as hand he soon had the whole realm praying for his death.
Lord Botterwell was renowned for wit, Miles Smallwood for courage, Sir Otto Hightower for learning. Yet they failed as hands, every one. As for birth, the Dragon Kings oft chose hands from amongst their own blood, with the results as various as Baelor Breakspear and Maegor the Cruel. Against this you have Septon Barth, the blacksmith's son the old king plucked from the Red Keep's library, who gave the realm 40 years of peace and plenty. Pylos smiled.
Read your history, Lord Davos, and you will see that your doubts are groundless.
How can I read history when I cannot read?
Any man can read, my lord, said Maester Pylos. There is no magic needed, nor high birth. I'm teaching the art to your son at the king's command. Let me teach you as well. It was a kindly offer, and not one that Davos could refuse. And so every day he repaired to the maester's chambers, high atop Sea Dragon Tower, to frown over scrolls and parchments and great leather tomes, and try to puzzle out a few more words. His efforts often gave him headaches, and made him feel as big a fool as Patchface, besides. His son Devon was not yet 12, yet he was well ahead of his father. And for Princess Shireen and Edric Storm, reading seemed as natural as breathing. When it came to books, Davos was more a child than any of them. Yet he persisted. He was a king's hand now, and a king's hand should read. The narrow, twisting steps of Sea Dragon Tower had been a sore trial to Maester Cresson after he broke his hip. Davos still found himself missing the old man. He thought Stannis must as well. Pylos seemed clever and diligent and well-meaning, but he was so young, and the king did not confide in him as he had in Cresson. The old man had been with Stannis so long, until he ran afoul of Melisandre and died for it. At the top of the steps, Davos heard a soft jingle of bells that could only herald Patchface. The princess's fool was waiting outside the maester's door for her like a faithful hound. Doe soft and slump-shouldered, his broad face tattooed in a motley pattern of red and green squares, Patchface wore a helm made of a rack of deer antlers strapped to a tin bucket. A dozen bells hung from the tines and rang when he moved, which meant constantly, since the fool seldom stood still. He jingled and jangled his way everywhere he went. Small wonder that Pylos had exiled him from Shireen's lessons.
"Under the sea, the old fish eat the young fish," the fool muttered at Davos.
He bobbed his head, and his bells clanged and chimed and sang,
I know, oh ho ho.
Up here, the young fish teach the old fish, said Davos, who never felt so ancient as when he sat down to try and read. It might have been different if aged Maester Cresson had been the one teaching him, but Pylos was young enough to be his son. He found the maester seated at his long wooden table, covered with books and scrolls, across from the three children. Princess Shireen sat between the two boys. Even now Davos could take great pleasure in the sight of his own blood keeping company with a princess and a king's bastard.
"Devon will be a lord now, not merely a knight. The Lord of the Rainwood."
Davos took more pride in that than in wearing the title himself.
"He reads, too. He reads and he writes, as if he'd been born to it."
Pylos had naught but praise for his diligence, and the master-at-arms, said Devon, was showing promise, with sword and lance as well.
"And he is a godly lad, too."
"My brothers have ascended to the Hall of Light to sit beside the Lord,"
Devon had said when his father told him how his four elder brothers had died.
"I will pray for them at the night fires, and for you as well, father, so you might walk in the light of the Lord till the end of your days."
"Good morrow to you, father," the boy greeted him.
"He looks so much like Dale did at his age,"
Davos thought. His elders had never dressed so fine as Devon in his squire's raiment, to be sure, but they shared the same square, plain face, the same forthright brown eyes, the same thin brown flyaway hair. Devon's cheeks and chin were dusted with blonde hair, a fuzz that would have shamed a proper peach, though the boy was fiercely proud of his beard,
just as Dale was proud of his once.
Devon was the oldest of the three children at the table. Yet Edric Storm was 3 inches taller and broader in the chest and shoulders. He was his father's son in that, nor did he ever miss a morning's work with sword and shield. Those old enough to have known Robert and Renly as children said that the bastard boy had more of their look than Stannis had ever shared. The coal-black hair, the deep blue eyes, the mouth, the jaw, the cheekbones,
Only his ears reminded you that his mother had been a Florent.
"Yes, good morrow, my lord," Edric echoed. The boy could be fierce and proud, but the maesters and castellans and masters-at-arms who'd raised him had schooled him well in courtesy. "Do you come for my uncle? How fares his grace?"
"Well,"
Davos lied. If truth be told, the king had a haggard, haunted look about him, but he saw no need to burden the boy with his fears.
"I hope I have not disturbed your lesson."
"We had just finished, my lord," Maester Pylos said. "We were reading about King Darren the First.
Princess Shireen was a sad, sweet, gentle child, far from pretty. Stannis had given her his square jaw and Selyse her florent ears, and the guards in their cruel wisdom had seen fit to compound her homeliness by afflicting her with grayscale in the cradle. The disease had left one cheek and half her neck gray, and cracked and hard, though it had spared both her life and her sight.
He went to war and conquered Dorne, the young dragon, they called him.
He worshipped false gods, said Devon, but he was a great king otherwise, and very brave in battle.
He was, agreed Edric Storm, but my father was braver. The young dragon never won three battles in a day.
The princess looked at him wide-eyed.
Did Uncle Robert win three battles in a day?
The bastard nodded.
It was when he'd first come home to call his banners. Lords Grandison, Caffrine, and Fell planned to join their strength at Summerhall and march on Storm's End. But he learned their plans from an informer and rode at once with all his knights and squires. As the plotters came up on Summerhall, one by one, he defeated each of them in turn before they could join up with the others. He slew Lord Fell in single combat and captured his son, Silver Axe.
Devon looked to Pylos.
Is that how it happened?
I said so, didn't I? Edric Storm said before the maester could reply. He smashed all three of them, and fought so bravely that Lord Grandison and Lord Caffrine became his men afterwards, and Silver Axe too. No one ever beat my father.
Edric, you ought not to boast, Maester Pylos said. King Robert suffered defeats like any other man. Lord Tyrell bested him at Ashford, and he lost many a tawny tilt as well.
He won more than he lost, though, and he killed Prince Rhaegar on the Trident.
That he did, the maester agreed. But now I must give my attention to Lord Davos, who has waited so patiently. We will read more of King Darren's conquest of Dorne on the morrow. Princess Shireen and the boy said their farewells courteously. When they had taken their leaves, Maester Pylos moved closer to Davos. My lord, perhaps you would like to try a bit of conquest of Dorne as well. He slid the slender, leather-bound book across the table. King Darren wrote with an elegant simplicity, and his history is rich with blood, battle, and bravery. Your son is quite engrossed.
My son is not quite 12. I am the king's hand. Give me another letter, if you would.
As you wish, my lord.
Maester Pylos rummaged about his table, unrolling and then discarding various scraps of parchment.
There are no new letters, perhaps an old one.
Davos enjoyed a good story as well as any man, but Stannis had not named him hand for his enjoyment, he felt. His first duty was to help his king rule, and for that he must needs understand the words the ravens brought. The best way to learn a thing was to do it, he had found. Sails or scrolls, it made no matter.
This might serve our purpose.
Pylos passed him a letter. Davos flattened down the little square of crinkled parchment and squinted at the tiny, crabbed letters. Reading was hard on the eyes, that much he had learned early. Sometimes he wondered if the citadel offered a champion's purse to the maester who wrote the smallest hand. Pylos had laughed at the notion, but...
To the... Five kings, read Davos, hesitating briefly over five,
which he did not often see written out.
The king be where?
Beyond, the maester corrected. Davos grimaced.
The king beyond the wall comes
comes south, he leads a vast host of wildlings. Lord Mum.